patient presents with acute urticaria, or hives, and after your comprehensive assessment, you decide to give them an antihistamine. But do you also give them a corticosteroid? Maybe some prednisolone to speed up the recovery from their hives? It's a pretty common practice. In a study of one emergency department in Italy, 93% of those presenting with acute urticaria were treated with steroids on top of their antihistamine. But it's a bit controversial. Today, we're looking into the evidence to answer the question, do corticosteroids provide any added benefit for the treatment of urticaria on top of antihistamines? Hello and welcome to the Evidence-Based Medicine podcast, where each week we pick a topic in medicine, examine the evidence, and tell it like a story. I'm Daniel Aronoff, and today, systemic steroids to treat urticaria. What's the evidence? So approximately 10% of us will develop acute urticaria at some point, and most of the time we have no idea what causes it. Idiopathic urticaria, where no trigger is identified, is actually the most common cause. I looked up the origin of the word idiopathic just for a bit of fun. Well, fun is a very strong word, I guess. Anyway, idios is Greek for one's own, and because pathos means disease, it literally translates to one's own disease? Huh? But we use it to mean when no cause can be found. So when a trigger for the urticaria is identified in about 40% of cases, most are due to drugs, then insect bites, then foods. Now, believe it or not, there have only been two randomized controlled trials to answer today's question. One done in the United States in 1995, and the other done in France in 2017. Let's start with the 1995 one, by a guy called Polak. So this was conducted out of one emergency department in Phoenix, Arizona, in America. Anyone who came into the emergency department over a seven-month period with a generalized itchy urticarial rash was enrolled in the study. Now, the rash had to be present for less than 24 hours, and if they had any signs of a more serious allergic reaction like angioedema or stridor, then they were excluded. Which is a real shame, actually, because I would love to know the role of steroids with angioedema. Anyway, they were also excluded if it was only a local allergic reaction, so it had to be generalized urticaria. If the patients agreed to be part of the study, then they were asked to rate their itchiness on a 10-point itchiness scale. They also documented the extent and location of the rash, and they were all given a 50 milligram intramuscular shot of diphenhydramine in the emergency room. And then they were randomized into two groups. The first group was sent home with an antihistamine and prednisolone. They were given 20 milligrams twice per day for 4 days. The second group was sent home with an antihistamine plus a placebo to take twice per day for 4 days. The antihistamine they used was hydroxyzine. Now, diphenhydramine and hydroxyzine were the two most common used antihistamines at the time. Boy, how times have changed. The patients and the nurses and the doctors were all blinded to the treatment they were getting. They got all the participants to come back to the ED 2 days later, where they had another look at the rash and made notes on it, and most importantly, repeated the itchiness score. And then, at day 5, they got a phone call to again give their itchiness rating out of 10 and to let the investigator know if they had any rash left over. They recruited 43 patients altogether, 19 in the placebo group and 24 in the prednisolone group. The average itch score when they presented to the ED was somewhere between 7.5 and 8, and a cause for the urticaria was only found in about 40% of them, which is consistent with the Italian cohort study that I mentioned earlier. When they got them back into the ED on day 2, the average itch score was now 4.4 in the placebo group and 1.3 in the steroid group. So a 3-point reduction in the 10-point itch scale with adding prednisolone to the antihistamine. At the day 5 mark, the itch score was 1.6 in the placebo group and 0 in the steroid group. So what do we have? Well, we've got one small study that showed a faster improvement in itch with taking 40 milligrams of prednisolone per day for 4 days, but that those who don't take steroid mostly all had resolution of the itch by day 5 anyway. So this is all we had for 22 years to guide us on this, until a study from France came out in March of 2017. This one was done by a guy called Barniol and was published in the Annals of Emergency Medicine. and they did something different. While they also used that 0 to 10 itch score, which by the way is literally called the itch score. But while the 1995 study measured the average change in the score between the two groups, this study presented on how many patients in each group got to an itch score of 0. So average change in score versus how many got to a score of 0. And while it seems like much of a muchness, they're actually pretty different. And I must say, I prefer it when they tell us how many got to a certain score rather than just tell us the average change in score. Because that way, you can get a number needed to treat. If you tell me that by giving steroids you reduce the score by an average of 3 points at day 2, it can be difficult to use that information. You can't actually calculate how many people would benefit from the steroids. Some would have had no difference in score, some might have had an increase in score, and some would have had a much greater reduction in score. There's no way to know how many people will benefit, just that on average there'll be a benefit of 3 points. But when you tell me what percentage of people reached a certain score, then you can calculate how many people actually benefited from the steroids, right? So let's say 80% of people got to a score of 0 with placebo, but 90% got to a score of 0 with steroids. The average change in score might be 3, but now you can know that only 10% of people benefited from the steroids, making a number needed to treat of 10. So that's why I prefer it. And that's what they did in this study. Sorry for the stats. So, they recruited 100 participants presenting with acute urticaria to one of two emergency departments. Again, they were excluded if they had angioedema or anaphylaxis. They had to have had the rash for less than 24 hours, and they can't have used steroids or antihistamines within the past 5 days. They were then randomized to either antihistamine plus steroid or antihistamine alone. The antihistamine they used this time was levocetirizine, 5 mg daily for 5 days, and for the steroid, they used prednisolone, 40 mg once daily for 4 days. Now, as soon as I read that they used levocetirizine, my conflicts of interest alarm went haywire. After all, it is just a newer, more expensive version of cetirizine. But alas, there was no conflicts of interest declared. And can we just talk about 40 mg of prednisolone for a sec? Because I see it being prescribed all the time and I can't think of a more inconvenient dose of anything ever. I don't know how it is in the rest of the world, but in Australia, all you can get is 5 mg doses or 25 mg doses. So taking 40 mg of prednisolone either means taking 8 5 mg tablets every day, or getting a script for both the 25 mg tablets and the 5 mg tablets, and then taking one of the 25 mg tablets and 3 of the 5 mg tablets every day. Now, did I just give you a headache? Because that's exactly how confusing it is for patients who are given this dose. And no wonder they get drug errors. I really don't think there's a difference between 40 mg and 50 mg. And it is so much easier for patients when they're prescribed 50 mg. But if 50 is too much, then go 25. Also easier and probably not that much different. Back to the study. So, they actually managed to recruit 710 patients, but most were excluded because they either had angioedema or had used an antihistamine before the ED visit, or because the rash had been there for more than 24 hours. So, they ended up with 100 patients. The primary outcome was, as I mentioned, how many people had a score of 0 out of 10 on the itch scale at day 2. They also checked itch scores at day 5 and 15 days and 21 days. Now, while I mentioned that I prefer when they state how many people got to a certain score in scale, I also still like it when they state the average change in score, and they didn't do this in this study. Oh well. I also wish they assessed how long it took to get to a score of 0 out of 10. That would be one of the most helpful pieces of information to give to patients, wouldn't it? That way we could tell them, on average, you'll get rid of your itch in 4 days with just antihistamines, or whatever days if we add steroids. They did do another outcome which I liked, which was how many in each group had complete resolution of their rash. The 1995 study did take down details of the rash when they were collecting the information, but didn't report on any results about the actual rash, just the itch. So, what did they find? Well, at day 2, 79% of those in the placebo group had absolutely no itch, a score of 0 out of 10 on the itch score. But in the prednisolone group, 62% had an itch score of 0. What? So prednisolone made the itch worse? And this was statistically significant. And what about the rash? Well, here there was no statistically significant difference between the two groups. By 2 days, 78% of those in the placebo group had complete resolution of the urticarial rash, while 70% did in the prednisolone group, but this was not statistically significant. For itch scores at all the other time points, 5 days, 15 days, and 21 days, there was no difference between steroids and placebo. There was also no difference in relapse rates. So what do we make of all this? Well, I would think the results showing worse itchiness with prednisolone at 2 days was probably a bit of a furphy. There was really no difference in any of the other outcomes except for this one, so it's most likely just a chance error. But who knows? Maybe prednisolone, when taken with levocetirizine, without any biological basis, makes you more itchy for a couple of days before magically the itchiness properties dissipate as you continue taking it so that by day 5 you don't have any extra itchiness. Yeah, I like it. That's what I'm going to start teaching my medical students from now on. I'm going to call it the itchiness paradox of prednisolone. No. Chance findings are all too common in research. In fact, there's a dark and stormy cloud that lurks over the scientific method, and it's called the reproducibility crisis. Allow me to explain. There was a researcher by the name of Glenn Begley, who was the head of hematology and oncology research at a very successful drug company called Amgen. They are best known for their drugs Aranesp and Prolia, but they make a heap of cancer drugs as well. So he became a bit obsessed with the whole reproducibility issue that was plaguing the scientific research. And given that he had access to like all the money and resources you could ever dream of through Amgen, he decided to pick 53 landmark papers in clinical biology, like good studies from excellent academic centers that were published in very reputable journals. And he decided he and his team of 100 scientists would replicate every single one of those studies. So why would he want to do that? Well, let's go back a bit. So let me ask you, if something is published in a high-profile peer-reviewed journal, would you trust the results? You're probably thinking, of course, why not? The whole scientific method is based on building on facts from those who came before, right? But what if I asked you this? Would you bet all your money that the results are true? See, this is what investors in the biotech industry have to deal with every day. A new landmark study is published, which makes a potential pharmaceutical intervention look very promising. They would need to invest hundreds of millions of dollars, but the return could be enormous, could make hundreds of millions of dollars look like chump change. But what if the science was wrong? Can we trust it? Most investors want to see that the original science is reproducible before they will invest the millions that it takes to build on that science. So why did Glenn Begley take the time and the money to try and reproduce all 53 of these studies? Because this had come just after the cancer drugs Gleevec and Herceptin had come out and were killing it. Both drugs were discovered because some research had found a single gene was responsible for certain types of cancer, and so these drugs were developed to fix that cancer-producing process. So Begley was on a mission to find the next Herceptin. All 53 studies, if true, could result in another breakthrough cancer medication. So this is what drug companies do nowadays. They could either invest 6 months to a year and a few hundred thousand dollars to try and first replicate a piece of research finding, or invest hundreds of millions of dollars with complete faith in that research finding, only to realize that they're at a dead end 5 years later because the research was false. Yes, this approach does risk being beaten by another drug company who just trusted the research and went full steam ahead, but the risks are so high that most drug companies are spending the money and the time to first validate the research before building on it. So here's what he found. Out of the 53 studies that he replicated, only 6 of them were able to reproduce the same result. 6 of them! He published this finding in the journal Nature, and it sent shivers through the scientific community. But he's not the only one. Researchers at a different drug company called Bayer's did the exact same thing, and were only able to reproduce 14 out of 67 studies. And they weren't just looking at studies in cancer. These were studies in cardiovascular disease and women's health as well. AstraZeneca and Novartis also did the same things and have found the same results. But even outside of the pharmaceutical industry, in the journal Science in 2015, a massive study got published called the Reproducibility Project, where researchers tried to replicate 100 different psychological studies that were published in the top 3 psychological journals, and they were only able to reproduce 39 out of the 100 studies. So whose fault is all this? Well, it's actually not really the point of the discussion, but some are blaming the publish or perish mentality in the research world, the fact that the KPI of the university, or the way they value and promote researchers, is based entirely on how many studies they publish. It means the quality of research suffers in order to get more and more published. But it doesn't matter who or what is at fault, you can't always trust that a piece of evidence will turn out to be true as more research is developed. So what does that mean? How should we deal with topics like ours that only have one or two small studies? Well, one way is to agree with it if it backs up our own practice and completely disregard it if it disagrees with our practice, and there you can blame the reproducibility crisis and the fact that we can't always trust research of just one study, but that's probably not the right way to do it. So what have we got? We've got an old study from 1995 with 43 patients that showed steroids on top of antihistamines speeds up the recovery of an acute episode of urticaria. Then we've got a larger study with 100 patients done in 2017 that showed that steroids made absolutely no difference to the recovery from acute urticaria. Now, one approach could be to say, well, the better study showed it made no difference, so I'm just not using steroids. Another approach could be, well, even if the steroids did speed it up a bit, they all eventually got better anyway. It's probably not worth the side effects for the potential for 1 or 2 days of less itch. And the third approach could be, I've always used steroids, it seems to work, and there is some evidence to back me up, so I'm just going to keep on using it. And I guess you'd all be right. For me, I never use steroids, and I like the fact that now, since March of 2017, I have some evidence to make me feel good about not using them. How will this evidence impact your practice? Let me know, I'd love to hear your thoughts. Okay, that's it from me. I really want to thank you all for listening, and I also want to give a special thanks to those who reached out to me recently to let me know that they're getting something out of the podcast. This feedback gives me great motivation to keep making the best episodes I could possibly make. Please subscribe to the podcast, and please, please, please leave a nice comment on iTunes. Check out the website where you can leave a comment and see the references. That's www.ebmpodcast.com. And check out my evidence-based videos on YouTube by searching Dr. Dan in YouTube. I'm Daniel Aronov. Talk to you next week.